This is a Hawaii Agricultural Foundation podcast for Eat, Think, Drink, Hawaii Regional Cuisine, the Evolution of Agriculture in Hawaii.
I'm Denise Yamaguchi, the Executive Director of the Hawaii Agricultural Foundation, and I want to thank you all for joining us for our eighth episode of Eat, Think, Drink, Hawaii Regional Cuisine, the Evolution of Agriculture in Hawaii. We launched Eat, Think, Drink in November of 2016 as an effort to spark meaningful conversation about important agricultural and food issues facing our community, and also to build and engage a larger network of conscious and caring consumers like you. Before we start, I'd like to send a big mahalo to our presenting sponsor, Hawaiian Airlines, and our supporting sponsors, Alexander & Baldwin, Alohilani Resort Waikiki Beach, Hawaii Crop Improvement Association, Honolulu Magazine and Honolulu Family, Kamehameha Schools, Lend-Lease, the State of Hawaii, and the Ulupono Initiative. Tonight, our topic is the Hawaii Regional Cuisine Movement, its evolution, and how it diversified agriculture in the state. The movement, as most of you know, was started by 12 chefs in 1991, committed to using fresh, locally sourced ingredients of the highest quality at their restaurants. These chefs were Sam Choi, Roger Daikon, Mark Elman, Amy Ferguson Ota, Bev Gannon, John Marie Jocelyn, George Mavro, Peter Merriman, Philippe Padovani, Gary Struhl, Alan Wong, and Roy Yamaguchi. Before I introduce our keynote speaker, I want to give a warm welcome to the four Hawaii regional cuisine chefs who are here joining us tonight. So will you please stand when I call you? Chef Bev Gannon. Chef George Mavro. Is George here? Chef Alan Wong. And Chef Roy Yamaguchi. He's greeting people at the door. Our special guest and keynote speaker, Dr. Sam Yamashita, flew in from California to be here with us tonight. He is a Henry E. Sheffield Professor of History at Pomona College. He recently released a new book, Hawaii Regional Cuisine, The Movement That Changed the Way Hawaii Eats, which was based on 36 interviews with chefs, farmers, and others connected to the Hawaii Regional Cuisine movement. I've asked him to focus his keynote tonight on the important role agriculture played in this movement and its evolution over time. After Dr. Yamashita's presentation, a panel with leaders and innovators of today's agricultural and food landscape will take place with Jehu Fuller, General Manager of Machiavelli Meat Company, one of the state's premier ranches specializing in bringing locally raised and sourced meats to consumers. Shin Ho, a second-generation farmer of Ho Farms, who after completing her degree in marketing and international business in California, returned home to Hawaii to revitalize her family business. Michelle Carr Ueoka from MW Restaurant, who is one of Hawaii's most celebrated chefs and owns MW Restaurant with her husband, Chef Wade Ueoka, and is also a co-chair of the Ag Foundation's Localicious Leadership Council. And moderating the panel is Dean Okimoto, former farmer and founder of Nalo Farms, who is also the chairman of the board for the Hawaii Agricultural Foundation. Now please join me in welcoming tonight's keynote speaker, Dr. Sam Yamashita.
Well, I'd like to thank Denise for inviting me to be the keynote speaker at the 8th Eat, Drink, and Think Symposium. Eat, Think, and Drink Symposium. Actually, when I accepted, I thought it was Eat, Drink, and Think. And then I learned later it was Eat, Think, and Drink. So it was about 100 degrees in L.A. when I left. So you rescued me from incredibly bad and inclement weather. It's also a great honor and pleasure to be part of a panel with my old friend Dean Okimoto and Michelle Carr Ueoka, whom I interviewed, and to meet Shirley Ho, Shin Ho, and Jehu Fuller. Thank you very much for agreeing to sit with me up front. And thanks of all to the chefs, Bev Gannon and Alan Wong, Roy Yamaguchi. Has George arrived yet? George Marvathalosidis for tolerating this stranger who showed up with questions. And one chef who will go unnamed kept saying, "You finished your thesis yet?" I said, "No, it's not a thesis. It's a book." So, but thank you very, very much for your tolerance and your goodwill. I was asked tonight to talk about Hawaii regional cuisine and the evolution of agriculture in the islands, and to share some of the findings in my new book, which is very short and very affordable, and would make a wonderful present. The unwritten rule in the publishing world is that if you write a book longer than 200 pages, it won't be accepted. So for all of you budding authors, shoot for 200 pages. But I'm happy to share my findings with you tonight and to focus on HRC and agriculture. And of course, I'm not an economic historian. I'm not an agricultural specialist. I'm someone who wrote a book on Hawaii regional cuisine. Now, the story of Hawaii regional cuisine and agriculture in the islands has many beginnings, and I wanted to mention three of them. Peter Merriman, one of the founding chefs of HRC, remembers that he wanted fresh coconut meat, and he couldn't get it. And he remembers seeing the workers at the Manalani cutting coconuts off the trees, I think to avoid lawsuits if tourists were hit by falling coconuts. And Peter, in his inimitably Peter Merriman way, said, "What are you doing with the coconuts?" And they said, "Oh, we're just throwing them away." And so Peter arranged to have the coconuts taken down to Kealakekua, where they were husked by a group of farmers, and the coconut meat was then sent north, and Peter had his fresh coconuts. And many years later, reflecting on that incident, Peter said, "You had to prime the pump to get the whole logistical system working." And that sort of sums up a lot of what happened with Hawaii regional cuisine and agriculture. Another beginning occurred when Roy Yamaguchi, Chef Roy Yamaguchi, called Dean Okimoto. And Dean said, "Well, I'm actually thinking of giving up farming." And Roy said, "Don't quit. We'll buy herbs from you, and I want you to grow other things." And Roy then started to invite Dean on these demonstrations at Liberty House, and he would say, "Come with me and you can explain the different greens." And Dean remembers that every time we did this, he writes, or he said, "I'd get 5 or 6 calls from restaurants, and that's how our business started growing." That's a true story, isn't it, Dean? Yeah, okay, good, good, good. The third beginning involves the late and deeply missed Kurt Hirabara, who was persuaded to come to Oahu with some of his herbs. And so I believe it was at the Halekulani, Kurt had some chervil in his hand, and he intended to give it to Gary Strail. But he was intercepted by Philip Padovani, who grabbed it. And I think Philip must have been stronger or taller, but in any case, I think he held it up high. And then at some point, he gave it up to Gary. But it was the beginning of a relationship between Kurt and the HRC chefs. Philippe also showed immense goodwill by introducing Kurt to the kitchens at the Halekulani and the Ritz-Carlton. And so these three stories really encapsulate the beginnings of that relationship between HRC and local agriculture. And to make a long story short, beginning in 1991, a platoon of farmers began to grow vegetables for the HRC chefs. And according to Tane Data, it went something like this. So Peter Merriman met with Tane, and they went over seed catalogs, and Peter circled the things he wanted. And Tane said, okay, I can grow that, I can grow that. And then Tane met with various farmers. I guess some of them weren't real farmers, he said, but they wanted to grow. And so Tane told them what to grow at what altitude. And that was the beginning of this relationship. They grew on small plots, 6 by 40 feet, using French intensive gardening techniques. And some of the farmers were even inventive. Erin Lee, and I'm sorry that I don't have a photograph of her, I couldn't find a photograph of Erin. And so these tomatoes will have to stand in for Erin. She apparently showed up at Peter's door with a box of herbs. And Peter said, actually, what I need are tomatoes. And so Erin went away. And 4 months later, Peter says, she came back in my kitchen with vine-ripened tomatoes. And what she figured out was that if she moved to a high enough altitude, the fruit flies wouldn't come up and prey on the tomatoes. And Peter told this story with some force, and it was confirmed when I interviewed Erin several years later. But the Big Island part of the story, I discovered, has another dimension. Big Island flower farmers were being hurt by South American growers who were using a new company called FedEx to ship their flowers to the U.S. And HRC, I gather, appeared in the nick of time offering new opportunities for these farmers, and this is one of the reasons that some of them began to grow for the HRC chefs. Now, as they began to grow for these chefs, the volume of what they grew also increased, and I was wondering, what did it look like? What kinds of volumes are we talking about? Hiribara Farms, at that point, was farmed only on 1.5 acres of land. Kurt and Pam grew 11 varieties of lettuce for 20 high-end restaurants. Nalo Greens, between 1998 and 1991, was harvesting about 1,700 pounds of herbs a week. I hope that's a correct figure, Dean. Okay, and which means, and they were growing mainly basil, but also parsley, oregano, marjoram, thyme, rosemary, and chives. And that came to about 7,000 pounds of herbs a month. So this is what the new relationship between the HRC chefs and the farmers looked like. And early on, in 1988, the herb business in the islands produced about $100,000. 3 years later, it was producing just over $1 million, I think $1 to $3 million, depending on whose estimate you followed. And I thought that's very telling and interesting and revealing about what this relationship looked like. Now, one might ask, why did this matter? Well, it mattered in the first place because HRC chefs now were given high-quality ingredients, and the ingredients that they needed and wanted were now being supplied in sufficient quantities. But the new relationship had another significance. It brought the restaurant world in the islands into line with the food revolution, so-called food revolution, then taking place on the mainland. And of course, it started with California cuisine. It started with Alice Waters and Jeremiah Tower at Chez Panisse in the 1970s. And of course, as many of you know, Alice Waters worked hard to get the very highest quality produce in the Bay Area. But apparently, as I understand it, Jeremiah Tower was the great chef at the restaurant. So these developments between this relationship between HRC and agriculture in the islands brought Hawaii into line with the other regional cuisines then appearing on the mainland. Of course, California cuisine was the first of these. There was also the new American cuisine represented by chefs in New York, but also by Charlie Trotter in Chicago, and by Dean Farring, who represents the new Southwestern cuisine. Like their counterparts on the mainland, the HRC chefs were offering a new vision of food. First, they were offering a new way to view the ingredients that they used to make their dishes, obviously a locavoric view of their ingredients. The ingredients no longer had to be imported from the mainland. They could be sourced locally, and this was a major change. And this obviously was the case with vegetables, with herbs, fruits, and coffee. But it also was the case with fish. What you may not know is that most high-end restaurants in Hawaii and on the mainland, even in New York City, were using frozen fish. And I think it was Eric Ripar at some point who said, why in God's name are we using frozen fish when New York has one of the great fish markets in the world? And in San Francisco as well, chefs were using frozen fish. And I was told that even Fisherman's Wharf used frozen fish. And I won't cite my source, but it was somebody who used to work there. The second thing, this new relationship, or the HRC chefs, the second element of their new vision of food was a new relationship between chefs and their producers. And as the relationship between Roy and Dean Okimoto reveals, it was a personal relationship. And some of those relationships continue to the present. I mean, many of you have relationships with these producers, and some of the chefs have relationships with the producers that go on into the present. The HRC chefs also help create and promote a new brand for food in the islands. Some of you know the famous quotation by that's cited by Coleman Andrews. And it's, what's her name? I'm forgetting her name. The famous food writer who said, when you come to the islands, be sure to bring some good olive oil and so you can buy some watercress and make a dressing and have good food. Who am I thinking of? What was her name? Alice Waters. It was Alice Waters, wasn't it? What? No. I think it was Alice Waters. It's in my book, and I'm having, you know, you finish a book and then you don't want to see it again for 1,000 years. I think it was Alice Waters, and she was quoted by Coleman Andrews. But in any case, it was a condemnation of food in the island. So in any case, the HRC chefs helped create and promote a new brand for food in the islands. This also encouraged others to start growing good food, but also to start growing good food for the supermarkets, for Times, for Star, for Safeway, for the KTA markets, and Foodland. In the fourth place, the HRC chefs also created opportunities for expanding diversified agriculture. I think this everybody in the islands understands at some level. But it also meant that people could cultivate new crops. And one of these were premium kao coffees that I didn't know about until I ate at Alan Wong's and began to have these premium coffees. Some of them were aged even. And then there was also sea asparagus, which I'd never had. And of course, it was grown in Kahuku, and it was served both at Roy's and Alan Wong's, and that's where I first encountered it. And of course, today, shrimp, kampachi, abalone, and lobsters are grown in the Kona area and find their way, not just Kona, but Kauai and Oahu, as well as the Big Island, and they find their way onto the plates at these fine dining establishments. And finally, the HRC chefs also produced a new paradigm, or a new discourse, this kind of academic language, a new chef producer paradigm or discourse. Now, all of this was important because there was something else going on in the islands at that time. As some of you know, Big Sugar and Big Pineapple were declining already in the 80s and 90s. Consider the following statistics, quite shocking. In 1980, there were 14 sugar plantations, 4 pineapple plantations, farming about 300,000 acres. And you also know that the last operating sugar mill in the islands was the Hawaiian Commercial and Sugar Mill in Pu'unene on the island of Maui. And of course, that closed in December 2016. And of course, in 2017, sugar and pineapple were being farmed on only 5,000 acres. So roughly a 36-year drop from 300,000 to 5,000 acres. This decline and end of big sugar and pineapple was important, obviously, because it meant, in the first place, a loss of jobs. And in the case of the HCNS mill on Maui, the closing of the mill meant the loss of 675 jobs. But we're told that for every job lost at a sugar mill, seven other jobs were affected. And so those 675 jobs really translated to about 5,000 jobs. And of course, for a lot of us, the end of the sugar and pineapple industries was very personal. Many of our families worked in the pineapple and sugar industries. My father worked at Dole Pineapple in payroll for over 30 years. And I spent five summers slaving away at Dole in Iwilei, a really important part of my education. I mean, I think I'm a better person for having worked, you know, at Dole. And some of you, I think, Alan, you worked in the fields, didn't you, in Wahiawa? I asked to be allowed to work in the fields, but my parents said, oh, no, you're not tough enough. You know, you're not strong enough. And so I became a janitor in the label department at Dole in Iwilei. The second thing that the decline and end of big sugar and big pineapple represented, of course, was the elimination of two major pillars of the local economy, two major pillars that had been around since the late 19th century or the early 20th century. And of course, it also meant that there was only tourism. And of course, many of you remember that the impact that the 9/11 attacks had on the tourist trade. I think, George, when I interviewed you, you talked about being on a plane to France on 9/11. And George said something in his inimitably George Marvelosus way, like, ooh, I'm doomed or something. And I think you turned around and came back, didn't you? And of course, the recession on the mainland and the recession in Japan also has had a huge impact on the tourist industry and also on fine dining in the islands. But the end of big sugar and big pineapple also made possible a new kind of agriculture. It created opportunities for diversified ag. This was noticed very quickly by ex-Governor George Ariyoshi, who in 2003 pointed out, and I quote, diversified agriculture crops had made up for the massive losses of sugar. I don't know if that's a completely correct statement, but I think it was a well-intentioned statement. That is, it began to make up for some of the losses. And the new department, head of the Department of Agriculture, chimed in later that year in 2003, noting that, quote, diversified agriculture does things like give us products for both local consumption and export. And of course, all of this created new opportunities for the chefs and their producers. So what did they do? They offered models of successful chef-producer collaboration. In fact, one might argue, I think if Tane Datta were here, he would argue that it enabled his success. Tane remembered that when he was first growing, I think he had 7.5 acres of land in Honaunau, and he didn't produce enough for the local food brokers to help him. That it was what he was producing was regarded as insignificant. And what Tane says is that the HRC chef's willingness to be creative and to use whatever we supplied made everything possible. Nalo Farms almost shut down in the late 80s, by the early 2000s, it was doing 700,000 in annual sales, growing for 80 restaurants on Oahu and for local supermarkets. The producers also innovated in various ways. I mentioned Erin Lee and her figuring out how to grow tomatoes in Waimea. There also were two strawberry farmers on Maui who started to grow strawberries on the slopes of Haleakala. They started at a lower altitude, and over the course of the strawberry growing season, they went higher and higher. Do you remember this, Dean? Because you were the distributor, I think, for those two growers, and you probably, and you, Bev Gannon remembers their strawberries. The third thing that the HRC chefs producers did was to create infrastructure. And infrastructure doesn't mean a lot to those of us who are not in the business, those of us who are not in ag, those of us who are not in restaurants, but nothing happens without infrastructure. And so Tain Data, for example, began with a distribution and warehousing system that collected produce from 35 farms and distributed it to 40 resorts and restaurants. His company now handles the produce of 100 growers supplying 80 restaurants. So what made this possible were these new relationships with the HRC chefs. Dean Okimoto did similar things on Oahu, and Kurt Hirabara created something called Kamuela Fresh on the Big Island. So all things considered, I would argue, and this is what academics do, we argue, I would argue that HRC chefs shaped the evolution of agriculture in the islands in five ways. First, they helped develop a market for local agriculture, for greens, obviously, tomatoes, fruits, coffees, local dairy products, eggs, fish and shellfish produced by local aquaculturists, and of course, cheese and beef. I learned about Jehu Miller's operation and was impressed by how much he's exporting to the mainland. HRC also nurtured symbiotic relationships with their producers, and this was noticed and recognized by the national media. Some of you will remember the article in Gourmet magazine in October 2007, where Peter Merriman, Alan Wong, and Neil Murphy were singled out. Peter Merriman was described in this way. The Gourmet writer wrote, 20 years ago, tourists went to Hawaii, loved the beaches, and lamented the food. Peter Merriman was one of the pioneers who changed that. Back then, his restaurant was an oasis of simplicity and sanity on the Big Island. Alan Wong was remembered by the Gourmet writer in this way. Alan Wong goes all out in his attempt to give diners an authentic Hawaiian experience, sourcing his ingredients from a long list of island farmers and ranchers. And I should mention that Alice Waters was also mentioned in that article. The third thing that the HRC agriculture relationship produced was a new view of fresh produce. And thanks to the hard work of Joe Namkun and Dean Okimoto, we had a wonderful, still have a wonderful farmers market on Saturdays at KCC on the slopes of Diamond Head. But in addition to that, there are five other markets operating within 5 miles of this spot. There are five other markets on Oahu, and there are six on the Big Island and one on Kauai, and Dean says there's one coming on Maui. And so all of this started, one might argue, with the HRC chefs and their new relationship with agriculture. And fourth, the HRC chefs have also drawn our attention, the public's attention, to major issues. Peter Merriman wrote two powerful editorials in the Honolulu Dailies, pointing out the dangers of the overfishing of deep water bottom fish. And so now I gather the catch is regulated as a result. And opakapaka has been replaced by tilapia on many menus. And I never used to like tilapia until I had it at Allen's restaurant. And the chefs have also talked about sustainability ad nauseum. And of course, that is a huge issue for the islands. And the last thing I would mention is that the HRC chefs have made locavorism cool. And I didn't use the adjective cool much, but my students use it so much that in order to communicate, I started to use cool. But I don't use it with people my age or older. But certainly the HRC chefs have made locavorism cool. My closing remarks are two things that I thought I should mention. In the first place, it's probably important not to overstate the impact of HRC, which is another way of saying I don't think HRC should be blamed for shortcomings. And I think one needs to recognize that there are many who produce for the general public and who don't produce just for fine dining establishments. There are many who produce for export, such as Jehu and the macadamia nut and the coffee farmers, the banana farmers, the egg producers, the papaya growers, and the guava puree makers on the various islands. And of course, Hawaii still exports sugar and pineapple, but now in small quantities. And we, for a time, we also had a growing seed industry, but I gather it's not doing as well right now. But the other thing that I would close with is that I think the state and local authorities, based on my work, deserve some recognition. The Hawaii Department of Agriculture has done a lot, obviously. I mean, Dean knows this. The chefs know it. They've created quarantine protocols for certain vegetables and fruits. They've maintained the all-important fruit fly suppression programs. They've encouraged the building of an irradiation facility near the airport. And the other development boards of other counties also deserve credit. I was struck by what the Kauai Economic Development Board has done in developing the workforce on Kauai, disseminating information useful to producers, facilitating access to capital, and helping with the development of business strategies and things of that sort. And I meant to ask Jehu before the talk whether he had benefited from the advice of the Kauai Economic Development Board. You don't have to answer now, but I meant to ask you. And the sad fact remains that 80 to 85% of what is consumed in the islands is still imported. This is a reality. I wonder to what extent can that change? Secondly, how does one do that? And thirdly, what is realistic? What is realistic? And I think for those of us above a certain age, what is realistic is the $64,000 question, right? We know what that means. What is realistic? And so that's the last thing I would leave with you. Thank you for your attention, and let's have a good time with the panel. Thank you. You want us to, okay.
I guess I'm supposed to start it, Denise, as a moderator? Oh, okay. I'm just checking. Well, you know, as you heard from Mr. Yamashita, how this movement started and this group of chefs started all of this, a lot of the things that have happened over the years were really timing, you know, of who was around and who met who. My chance meeting of Roy was through Chuck Furuya. You know, I knew Kurt was in Waimanalo before he went to the Big Island to farm, so I had known Kurt also. And, you know, we had always talked about this and how we could get more of our products out into the general public. And, you know, back then we didn't know about branding or anything like that, but we learned quickly that having people like, you know, Peter, Roy, George, using the products and basically promoting it helped all the farmers with their sales and becoming well known, because a lot of times you go into restaurants and they'd ask, okay, who are you selling to? And you just mention, oh, Roy Yamaguchi or Alan Wong or George Mavro. They would all go like, oh, okay, we'll buy from you too, you know? So it's like a validation. I mean, you know, that's how they brought this movement forward and it just grew from there. And that's my feeling. It was that I just met them at the right time and Plus, I was also not real happy with the system back then of how we had to sell to wholesalers, and they would tell you what they would buy it for price-wise. And that wasn't, you know, that wasn't in my culture back then. So I didn't like that. Anyway, those are some of the things that I think helped the movement at the beginning. And in today's world, you know, with we always talk about sustainability. We talk about growing agriculture and helping our local economy with the tourism industry and everything else. And agriculture is key to it. It's very key because we can do things with products that, well, we can grow products that these women and men that are chefs that we have here in Hawaii can do amazing things with them. And this doesn't only include the HRC chefs. I mean, there's a lot of young chefs here like Lindsay and Colin Hazama and Michelle and, you know, that really are doing magnificent things with our local products. And the beauty of it is they seek it out. That's the other part. They want these products. And I think that makes it even more important for farmers going forward to look at that and hopefully produce more for these people. The problems going forward with sustainability and everything else are, I think the largest thing is probably climate change. I will tell you, it is here. There is climate change. And we all need to be conscious of it. And we all need to start looking at ways of mitigating some of the things that happen from it. Also, going forward, because of climate change, I do think agriculture needs to change. And we need to look at technology in a major way of doing more things indoors. It's more expensive up front, but it's more of a guarantee that there's a constant supply and those types of things. Okay? Workforce is another thing that, you know, not only farms but restaurants have a problem with it. And those are the things that are going to affect how we grow and how we sustain ourselves going forward. Okay? So with that being said, from my part, and, you know, Denise told me, shut up at some point. So I'm going to shut up and I'm going to start with Jehu and ask Jehu, you know, what you see in your industry, how are you looking at it and growing your business to be sustainable, and what do you see at it offering to the state of Hawaii as far as a product that we can be proud of as a state?
Well, the first part, I think so, is creating relationships with the ranchers that got them vertically integrated, because as we all know, land is very valuable in Hawaii. So the last thing you want to do is put some cows on it if you can lease it out or build something on it. But so we had to convince the ranchers that there's benefits. So getting them vertically integrated from top to bottom and building a brand around their ranch or something like that. And then they see the economic benefits to keeping product in Hawaii. Then putting the infrastructure in to make a better product. So one thing that we've done is just we've irrigated pastures to mitigate drought, but to get a better finished product for our cattle.
How do you see mitigating environmental problems with the cattle industry as far as what you guys do to make sure that you're not affecting our natural resources and things like that?
Well, not other than irrigating the pastures too, because there is environmental problems with drought, and so we've irrigated about 1,000 acres. But as with the finishing pastures, it's not around, you know, any big rivers where people can get upset. So that's the main one. And I would think just keeping the entire process on property as much as possible, so the least amount of transportation and shipping things back and forth has really helped.
Thank you. Shin, you know, you're I still remember you coming home and meeting you for the first time, and you saying, I don't know what I'm doing here farming, you know, and I think you, a lot of us were in that position when we started out working. But what do you see as the future of local ag and sustainability, and how you and your family and your farm can mitigate some of these things for Hawaii?
I think one of the first things I think of is that as a business, we have to continue to be successful. Because when I came here 13 years ago, you know, I looked up to Nalo Farms, Hamakua, tomatoes, and, you know, when you guys said, hey, I'm going to tap out and I don't want to do this business anymore, you know, it kind of freaked us out a little bit. Like, did we make the right choice? Like, you know, like, why are we here? Are we going to be able to survive? It's really hard to do business in Hawaii. Produce prices are affected by imports. So what we are able to sell is somewhat affected by imports. And I think that it's our job to ensure that our customers understand how their food is produced here and, you know, why does it cost more, you know, that it's nutritious, it's safe. And it's our job to keep having conversations with other growers and share information so that we can be successful.
What do you see as factors that can help local farmers be sustainable going forward? Because, you know, as you look at with all the new rules and regulations and you know, basically pitfalls that farming has, how do you see farming growing and becoming something really, 20, 30, 40% of our economy or what we produce for our people?
I see there's a lot of opportunity because there's a captive market. You know, there's people want to buy local. And there's a lot of imports to replace. So there's also a lot of people interested in farming. But it's very challenging to get started because of the cost of, you know, being a farmer. Because you think people forget, or, you know, they look at me and they're like, you don't look like a farmer. But it's a lot more dynamic than just putting a seed in the ground, watering it, and harvesting it. You know, today I was at the farm in Wahewa, extremely windy, meaning our eggplants are not going to be grade A marketable for the supermarkets next week. So what I projected is only going to be half. Did that answer your question?
Yeah, no. I mean, you're putting it out there that, you know, as much as we would want to, as farmers, be able to tell you exactly how much we can produce 3 weeks from now, and these are what some of the supermarkets ask from us, by the way. You know, they want to know, and then if you can't produce, you basically sometimes they penalize you, you know. So I just want people to realize that what you see in grocery stores a lot of times, and when you see it at the prices that you're seeing it at, it's generally something that's decided a long ways in advance and has nothing to do with the weather, which the farmer has to pay the price for in the long run, okay? Moving on, Michelle. You know, Michelle and I have always argued about Puno and Iolani, by the way. So, Punoho, Iolani. But it's a lot of fun. I mean, I love Michelle. I think the world of her. I think the world of her food. I wanted to ask her how she sees, you know, she really likes to nurture relationships with farmers. And, you know, is it, I know it's partly in you yourself to do that, but how do you get yourself to get jacked up about, you know, all the new things you see all the time? Because you're generally a pretty jacked up person to begin with, too. That's meant as a compliment, okay?
That's a new word for me. Well, first of all, You know, I wanted to thank all the HRC chefs because it's become a way of life for me. You know, with the mentorship of all Chef Allen and Roy and them, they instilled that it was a philosophy, and part of our job as a chef of the next generation is to continue on and pass on to the cooks that we work with and generations after what they started 28 years ago. And I guess to answer your question about why I get jacked up, and I've never said that word before. I didn't learn that word at Punahou. It wasn't in the dictionary.
Well, that was the Ilani, that's why.
Okay, but you know, part of it is it's because of all of their hard work. The ranchers, the farmers, the fishmongers, they make our jobs as chefs easy. So when we talk to Shin or Mark Suisu from Makaha Mangoes and them, and they tell us what they're growing, I get excited because it tastes so good. You can taste the love that they put into their farming, and it tastes in the product that they sell. You know, Chef Allen taught us that happy cooks make happy food, and that's what I believe with the farmers. Happy farmers, ranchers, fishmongers, they develop great product, and it's our job as chefs to respect the integrity of the product and highlight it. And it's really easy when they make such wonderful produce and everything. And part of it, what's fun is too, is to share when with your other chef friends and share these farms with them. So when Lindsay or Garrett calls us and will say, oh, there's this new farm, and vice versa, they'll tell us about a new farm or a new ingredient. And that's how we spread it. We do it one person at a time.
That's great. Sam, you know, what kind of community involvement do you think is needed to move the needle on local food production? In other words, increase food production and make an impact on sustainability for our islands?
Of course, Dean, I answer this question as somebody who lives in Los Angeles.
Yeah, I know. Okay. But you see it around in your travels and things, too, of how people do it differently in different communities.
Well, I think it requires the agreement and cooperation between the producers, policymakers, and then the citizenry. And I live in Claremont, California. We have a wonderful farmers market. But the truth is that it's more expensive than other places. I'm not sure the things we buy and consume are grown in a sustainable way. I mean, lots of problematic dimensions. And, you know, if the answer were simple, then we'd all be multimillionaires. But the fact is that these are problems with incredibly difficult and almost insoluble dimensions. And I, you know, I'm sad that climate change is affecting the islands. And I grew up in Kailua, and of course I see the beach eroding. And would I buy land at sea level in Kailua? I don't think so. Would I buy land in Kaka'ako? I don't think so. And I shouldn't say that because a lot of you have invested millions. I think I'd buy land in Manoa or St. Louis Heights or Tantalus. But these are extraordinarily complex issues, and of course, national politics just isn't helping much. And I won't say more, but clearly problems are not being addressed in the way that we would hope smart, thoughtful, rational people would address these issues. So how's that, Dean? Is that okay?
That's pretty good.
Okay, okay.
I wasn't expecting
to have to answer questions. That wasn't part of the deal.
I don't know who you were referring to as the smart, rational people, though. That's the thing. But I kind of figured part of it out. So, in fact, it's going to lead to the next question to Jehu and Shin in that, and, you know, we have a, by the way, we have a former director of Department of Ag here. I saw Scott Enright over here earlier, so I know he's here somewhere. But he took his hat off.
I'll give up my chair. What do you like?
But you know, what do you see as in your businesses as far as working with the government and how government can help the cattle industry or the ag industry, and what are some of the obstacles that have been placed in your way in growing your businesses and making it, you know, profitable? Because I don't think the general public knows some of the things that farmers and ranchers have to go through to produce that product that's put on your plate.
Imports affect our business, and it affects the way that it's going to grow. We don't plan on really expanding the farm, but we just want to produce enough to, you know, for the people who want to buy a good local quality product. And what government needs to do is create policies that encourage local buying in the larger institutions.
For the beef industry, I see we have to first break down all the infrastructure and get something brand new. I mean, we have to overhaul the processing facilities. We got to compete like we're competing with the mainland. We got to scale up. We got to have food safety. That's the biggest thing. Food safety is huge. If you want to do business with the Siskos of the world, you got to have food safety. If you want to go back to the West Coast, you got to have food safety. But the facilities are just, you know, lack of better words, is not safe. Is, you know, can be better. So that to me is a challenge, and finding the right partners, the right people that think that way to partner with and then scale up and do that.
Okay, I think I wasn't watching the timekeeper over here at all, so I missed that, but I guess we're going to go to question and answers now. So, you know, if some of you have questions, please.
Thank you so much for this panel. Thank you, Sam. Hi, Dean. It struck me that one a place that your book kind of ends, Sam, because you're really talking about more first wave of Hawaii of HRC chefs, and where it's taken off from there is really the emphasis on sustainability and the use of local products such as breadfruit, which we wouldn't have seen, right, 20, 30 years ago on a fine dining table. So I wonder if anybody can comment on the move toward local products, more breadfruit. Taro is a bit expensive, but what you do with that and how that might create a kind of sustainable relationship between producers and chefs.
So I think sustainability, when I think about like how you talk about the breadfruit and we haven't seen it 20 years ago and then now, I think what's interesting is the curiosity that also that there's more farmers available now and it's becoming more diverse and people are willing to grow different things. So if we see more ulu, we see more taro, we see just today we got figs in. And so as farmers are becoming more diversified and there's more a variety of products coming out there, there's more things that are available to the consumers, not only at restaurants, but at the farmers market and at the grocery stores as well. So the education gets out there. And when it's one person at a time, that's how I think in some way we're going to grow the local agriculture, is because when there's more demand, then the prices will start to come down, and it goes, you know, both ways. So by investing and more people buying locally, we will see that happen. And what's really nice is in 2014, the Hawaii Department of Agriculture started the Localicious campaign, and this past year, over 200 restaurants participated, and in March, and each restaurant featured a different dish using local agriculture. So when you think about 200 restaurants featuring different ingredients from local farmers, ranchers, or fishermen, then it slowly creates a bigger movement.
Aloha, I'm Ellie, and I am a public school teacher. So I'm here because, you know, I'm teaching STEM and also Genius Hour, which means that my students have to be creative and be critical thinkers and be really, you know, the solution. So my question would be, if I have my students, you know, I go back in a few weeks, to be able to bring this, you know, this news about sustainability, what are the three things that we need to remember as, you know, as people who live in Hawaii? In terms of if they're going to be entrepreneurs, what are those characters, the qualities do they need to be able to be successful in the area of, you know, food industry, becoming chef or farmers and ranchers? Thank you.
Well, I had some kids come into the processing facility where we'll call it the abattoir slaughterhouse. And it's interesting is I asked the kids, where do you think the steak come from? And was very honest. One of the boys raised his hand and he said, Safeway. And I said, that's true, but where it really comes from? But the thing is, they didn't know. And that's kind of sad. So we took them out to the holding pens, and I said, this is where the ribeye come from. And they look at the cow, and it's standing looking at them, and they're like, oh, what? Maybe a couple of them went to become vegetarians, help her business. But, you know, teaching the kids about where it comes from, how it's produced, educating them, and teaching them that being hard workers that way is not a bad job. It can be a good job. Not everybody has to be in the computer field. But teaching them that's my take.
I think one of the most important things in whatever you do is passion. I mean, if you meet Alan, Mavro, Bev, and Roy, and all these chefs, Michelle, you're going to see and you're going to feel the passion. And that's exactly what you should feel when you go to a farmer's market and you talk to Shin or all of these producers at the market that are there selling their produce, because it, you know, not to get big-headed, but I used to be very proud of what I did. And, I love doing what I did. And that's a key part of, to me, what kids need to understand going forward.
We have time for one more question. So if anyone wants to ask a question, because he's not asking anyone if they want to ask a question, I'll ask.
I'll ask a question. Can you hear me? Okay. So this is a question that I run into, and it kind of spins off of what you're saying. I think we're really removed from where our food comes from. And I think we're becoming increasingly more consumer-oriented. And you know, I'm doing mangoes because nobody does mangoes anymore. And there was a time that everybody had a mango tree. Now nobody has a mango tree. And so I think what I'm seeing is this idea of having this experience of going to see where food comes from. It's like going to the zoo. You know, I see people saying, that's where a banana tree comes from. Your point about the food came from Safeway, I think there's a huge need for that side of the industry to develop. I'm getting calls all the time where people want to come and visit the mango tree. You probably get people want to visit the farm. I think that's where the next wave is going to come from. If we continue to become more and more consumer-oriented and not having a good feel for where the production comes from, I think we're going to lose. And I think that's a big part of what needs to happen here is to develop that attention. And that's what's working with you, Michelle, is you have the connection with the chefs. You have the connection with the farms. And I think that's what all of us need to be doing in some way. And I don't think we have an industry that does that really well. People are calling me because they don't know where to get a mango tree. They don't know how to do this. I think that's a huge part of our industry that needs to happen. I don't know where it's going to come from, but I think that's where we all need to look at it. You guys might want to chime in, though.
You're absolutely right, and I think that's why one of the points I said was, you know, my job is to educate, is to make people feel comfortable about what they're buying and to re-inform them about the way food is grown now, you know. And for the farm, for our farm, we do eventually want to get into doing some education and bringing kids in and showing them, you know, like, how does a tomato grow? How long does it take?
And for me, it's having the kids taste the product and got to re-educate their palate because they think beef should taste what they buy from the mainland. But try and create some competition between them. I'd rather have this ranch over that ranch. Without, you know, they can't drink wine, but for us, we love different flavors of wine because of the different characteristics of terroir. But when it comes to beef, oh, got to be taste bland or no taste at all. So educating the kids' palates will help them want these local products in our field.
Yeah, and from the chef side, I think for them seeing the products kind of side by side, showing them what a tomato does taste like, what a mango tastes like, what a really good pineapple tastes like, you know, and then sometimes taking them to the farm, seeing how it grows, and then taking it all the way and showing them what we do with it. And I think that was amazing to me is one day I took my nephew to one of our coffee farms, and our coffee farmer asked him, oh, do you like coffee? And he was 8, and he goes, no, I hate coffee. I'm like, no, don't say that. This is our coffee farmer. And he was like, no. So I asked him, I said, do you like coffee ice cream? He goes, that's my favorite ice cream, Auntie. So when he saw the coffee, then he appreciated it more. And then he saw all the hard work that went into to make that coffee. And then he saw the ice cream. And it was like, you bring everyone together. And he was like, wow, that was really an interesting experience.
One real quick story. You know Alan Wong, one time I go to his restaurant and he goes, hey, you tried the tilapia? I go like, no. So he goes, try them. So I tried it, I ate it, and I was like, I went back to him and go like, this is not tilapia. Fish was firm, was tasty. I said, mahi or some other white type of fish. He goes, promise, tilapia. I was president of Farm Bureau at the time. Next week, I go out to this tilapia farm out past the glider field out in Waiawa, whatever. Okay? So I meet the farmer and he pulls out this tilapia. Swear to God, it had to be about that big. So I go like, who buys that? The guy goes, oh, Alan Wong. So I found out that day that if you buy tilapia in the market, you buy them 1 pound, the fish is a little bit mushy. But if you fillet a 5 pound tilapia, the fish is firm and it's really tasty. So I don't know if I'm giving away Alan's secret, but you know. But I learned something really, to me, that was pretty neat, the way he did that. He didn't know I was going to that farm though.
Okay, I want to thank the panelists because it's 7:15 and I know all of you want to go upstairs to eat and drink. I want you to continue the conversation. We have another 2 hours of eating and drinking. And I also wanted to put in a plug for the Hawaii Agricultural Foundation because our mission is really to connect farmers to the community. We have a number of educational programs for the schools. So if you're an educator and you're interested in what we do, we serve over 5,000 kids and we actually pay for the school visits to the farms. So if you're interested in that, please come talk to one of us. We also have a CSA program. We work with local restaurants. And so thank you all. And again, we put this Eat, Think, Drink on so all of you can be part of the conversation. And I want to thank all of you for being here this evening. I want to give you a... lastly, I want to talk about who's upstairs on the 5th floor at the Swell Bar. We have 5 chefs, Michelle Cartwayoka from MW Restaurant, who's here, but she's going to be upstairs, David Lukela from Alohilani, Andrew Lay from Pig and the Lady, Colin Hazama from Royal Hawaiian, and Chris Kajioka from Senia. And I'd also like to thank Dr. Yamashita one more time for flying all the way from California for being here this evening. He does have copies of his book available for a special price of $15. It's published by the University of Hawaii Press. And he also has two more speaking engagements this weekend, Saturday at the shop in Mo'ili'ili at 3:30 and on Sunday at Bookends in Kailua at 1:30. I also need to acknowledge our beverage sponsors because most of you like eating and drinking. And so Anheuser-Busch, I'd like to acknowledge Anheuser-Busch, Fiji Water, and Southern Glazer's Wine and Spirits. If your friends missed tonight's Eat, Think, Drink, it will be available via video and podcast on Hawaii Ag Foundation's YouTube and SoundCloud. And I want to thank Makaha Studios for making that possible. I hope you stay connected and continue the conversation about what you learned this evening. On behalf of the Hawaii Agricultural Foundation, mahalo and enjoy the rest of the evening.